Good afternoon, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dr. Colleen Wilcox, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and your moderator for today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Jamie Metzl. Jamie is a senior advisor to a New York-based global investment firm, and he served as executive vice president of the Asian Society, deputy staff director of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, senior coordinator of the International Public Information at the U.S. Department of Education, director of multilateral affairs on the National Security Council, and as a human rights officer of the United States, of the United Nations in Cambodia. He has served as an election monitor in Afghanistan and the Philippines and advised the government of North Korea on the establishment of special economic zones. Jamie appears regularly on national and international media discussing Asian economics and political issues, and his syndicated columns on Asian affairs and genetics and other topics is featured regularly on publications around the world. He has testified before Congress, outlining emergency preparedness recommendations after 9/11, and on the national security implications of the biotechnology and genomics revolution, and is the author of The History of the Cambodian Genocide and the novel The Depths of the Sea, both of which were published by St. Martin Press, and his new novel, Genetics Code, was published this month. Jamie was a former White House fellow and an Aspen Institute Crown Fellow. You're beginning to get the idea. He is the honorary ambassador to North America of the Korean Ministry of Trade, Industry, and Energy. He holds a PhD in Asian history from Oxford, a JD from Harvard Law School, and he is a magna cum laude and Pi Beta Kappa graduate of Brown University. He has completed 12 Ironmen, 24 marathons, and 9 ultra marathons, whatever that is. I have had the good fortune to sit across the table, Jamie, many times, and I can assure you there is not one topic with which he is not familiar, knowledgeable, and totally enthralling. Dr. Jamie Metz.
You get a hug. Mm-hmm.
Thrilled to be with you all. I'm thrilled to be here at the Commonwealth Club, but I'm only partly thrilled to be back in San Francisco. As you know, my new novel, Genesis Code, is set in Kansas City, and I happen to be from Kansas City. And while you guys have been winning World Series and winning Super Bowls left, right, and center, we poor suffering souls from Kansas City for 30 years didn't win anything. We had our one chance, and with this back and forth, and Colleen mentioned my connection to the North and South Korean governments, but I was at this ambassador's meeting in Korea, and I was in this very, very formal lunch, and it was the seventh game, ninth inning, and people are giving all these talks, and I had my cell phone, and I'm looking down, and there's two outs in the bottom of the ninth inning, and like, you get little updates, like, well, how did that guy get to third base? And it's like, somebody's on third base! Anyway, you know how the rest of the story goes, but congratulations. And I have to say, even having lost to the Giants, there was something very endearing about this team. I mean, it was like the big fat guy on third base who looked like he couldn't move anywhere, but he did all these magic tricks, and the guy who had his like leggings, like Flashdance leggings, up to his pants. So it was anyway. So I'm just kidding, but I'm absolutely thrilled to be here in San Francisco with all of you, and of course my good friend Bruce. And I'm going to talk. Really, it's kind of a three-in-one thing because it's three pieces of this story that come together. So, the first topic that I'm going to talk about is U.S.-China relations, which is huge. It's one of the most important issues of our lifetime. The second topic, which is connected to U.S.-China relations, but I think much bigger, is the issue of human genetic enhancement. And that's my novel deals with both U.S.-China relations and human genetic enhancement. And then the third topic I'm going to talk about as a subtle way of easing you over there towards that table where the lovely Renee will be handling things is to talk a little bit about the novel. So let's start with U.S.-China relations. As many of you know, President Obama just left Beijing after the APEC summit, which by all accounts went extremely well. This announcement of a number of agreements between the United States and China, the capstone of which is the climate change agreement, nothing is signed yet, but it will be, is certainly very, very positive. And this kind of agreement demonstrates what's possible when the United States and China work together. And as the two most important countries in the world, the U.S. and China working together will be absolutely essential for making this 21st century a peaceful one. And as you know, there have been many periods in history where there was a rising power and an established power, and with a relatively small number of exceptions, Britain and the United States being one, in very, very many cases, that kind of situation has often led to conflict. So while there is tremendous opportunity, are we good? Okay, good. Excellent. Thank you so much. But I'm counting on you. You did a great job of letting me know. So while there's a tremendous opportunity for a collaboration, there is an equal or even greater opportunity for conflict. And we're seeing the seeds of that conflict many places around the world, certainly in the East China Sea, in the South China Sea, in cyberspace. There are a lot of areas where the United States and our allies and China are increasingly rubbing up against each other. And there are real opportunities for things to get worse unless we collectively do everything we can to make them get better. And that certainly is the goal. And when we all think about China, everybody knows what these graphs look like. There's the prehistory, and people talk about China being more advanced than the West. For almost all of prehistory, that wasn't the case. But in about 600 AD, for 1,000 years, between roughly the 7th and 16th centuries, China was more advanced than the West. And when you all know the story of Marco Polo and people going to the East, and there was a civilization that was in many ways ahead of the West, which at that time was going through the Middle Ages and doing all these stupid things that many of our ancestors did. But at the time of the Mongol invasions, it created this land bridge between East and West. And a lot of these Chinese innovations, like paper and gunpowder and movable type and the compass and all of these things, went kind of from East to West. And then in roughly the 16th century, the West really started using many of these technologies imported from the East. But because of a different culture and a different idea of entrepreneurship and a different form of societal and governmental organization, these innovations, which hadn't been, from a Western perspective, brought to their ultimate use and ultimate potential in the East, were in the West. And then when the water bridge connected between Europe and the United States and the New World, that created a whole new avenue for wealth creation and growth and innovation and, most important, political change. And China was more centralized, and so, but in the West, there were all these little states that were fighting one another, so they used this Chinese-invented gunpowder and used, figured out how to use that to be incredibly deadly, which at the time of colonialism was something from a colonial perspective was very useful. The governmental structures changed because this new class of people, the entrepreneurs and the business people, became more important, and they demanded more political rights. So there was a whole series of changes. And so for the last basically 500 years, the West has been in the ascendance, and everybody else has not. And you know the whole history of which going from economic growth and innovation to colonization, which is a terrible history, but a reality. And these European ideas became universal ideas. And then what happened these two very important European ideas of sovereignty and nationalism burned themselves out in Europe through the Second World Wars and were delegitimized. But in Asia, when people think about sovereignty and nationalism, which were in many ways European imports, so in Europe, we think at the end of the Second World War in the West, we said, well, sovereignty and nationalism are the problem. And overcoming them through transnationalism is the answer. And that's why we have the UN and pooled sovereignty and NATO and EU and international law and all of those structures. From an Asian perspective, though, the lack of sovereignty. So sovereignty, people think back at the colonial period and thought, well, geez, if we had had a stronger sense of nationalism and more sovereignty, that would have been a pretty useful tool to protect ourselves against these Europeans who were coming in. So we're starting from very different backgrounds. And then you all know the history with China, that there was the revolution, and China then went through this horrible period, by far the most murderous dictator in the history of the world is Mao. There's different counts, there's some numbers of the body count, but it's whatever, 40 million to 57 million. But really, Mao was responsible for more deaths than Hitler, Stalin, the Second World War, really anything. But in the beginning, in the 1970s, the late 1970s, 1979, a new leader emerges in China, Deng Xiaoping, and puts China on a different course. And you all know what that is with economic reforms. And since that time, China has had the most miraculous and economic growth spurt, really in the history of the world. Faster, I mean, the U.S., our big growth spurt was from the end of the Civil War, basically to World War I. But China's has been faster. And so as China has increasingly gotten wealthier and wealthier, the Chinese Communist Party has played an essential role in that process. But there's a problem. And that is that China's leadership doesn't have democratic legitimacy. Nobody chose them. They took control by force through the revolution, and so they are in this constant situation where they need to demonstrate why they have legitimacy and to basically keep control of a population to maintain their position. And so, as China's government tries to assert its legitimacy, there are three major things that it does. The first is to continually hark back to the Chinese Revolution. And that is why when you go to Tiananmen Square, why Mao is there. Even the Chinese government talks about Mao being 70% right and 30% wrong, and there's a lot of dead bodies in that 30%. But they can't take that picture down because it's the revolution itself which gives them legitimacy. And that's why this narrative of that the revolution was the means that with which China reasserted itself against the humiliation of colonialism, particularly since 1989, because before that time the real focus was on class struggle, but particularly since 1979, this narrative of humiliation and victimization has been essential for the Chinese government. So that's one, is the connection to the revolution. The second is economic growth. The party and the government has delivered tremendous economic growth, but now it's stalling in many ways, and China has huge headwinds. Demographics, the people talk about China getting old before it gets rich. Natural resources, China is severely lacking in many critically important natural resources, not including human capacity, which it has great. There's an economy that is hugely misallocating resources, which is connected to the politics, because when one group is too powerful, and we know that in the United States, we have our issues of our campaign finance structure, and when one group is too powerful, that group ends up accruing chits. And that's why China is one of the most unequal societies in the world, because the Communist power is so firmly, the Communist Party is so firmly in control, and the way that you get rich in China, and it's not entirely different from here, but the way you get rich in China even more than here is through your connection to the party and the government. It's not only that, but that's critically important. And so China has succeeded enormously in this first phase of investment-led growth. But right now, in part because of a lot of inefficient investments, China is really coming to the end of the first phase of its growth, which is this investment-laden growth. And their productivity levels are going down very, very rapidly. So Chinese government, more than anybody, understands that they've aced this first phase of economic growth, which is exactly what the Soviet Union aced. But the next phase is, how do you become a consumption-led and innovation society? And that's a much, much bigger challenge. And China's leaders, Xi Jinping first and foremost among them, recognize this. And that's why they are carrying out right now a massive reform program. And it's primarily an economic reform program, because they recognize that economics and economic growth are not just a foundation for their legitimacy, but also for China's role in the future. But to do that, they need to have a political process to break this logjam and all the inefficiencies that are baked into the Chinese system. And that, in my opinion, others with different opinion, is why there's been this massive anti-corruption campaign, which in China, because the party itself, I talked about the democratic deficit, the party itself is inherently a patronage network. So you can't take corruption out of a patronage network. The definition of a patronage network is corruption. And that's why this anti-corruption campaign is trying to clean up a little bit of it. But what can you do? Xi Jinping's family, according to Bloomberg, is worth more than $1 billion. Wen Jiabao, according to New York Times, his family worth more than $3 billion. If you were to say, we're just going to strip the assets of all of the people connected to the top party leadership, basically that would be a massive revolution, and it can't happen, because that is the structure. So there's a anti-corruption campaign, which is inherently a political campaign, and the goal of that is to create space for economic reforms, which Xi and his team know are essential for moving China from this first phase of growth to the second phase of growth. But China faces a problem, and that is that to have reform, there's two ways that it can happen. One is the top-down, and they are betting the entire country that top-down reform can work, party-led reform. And that's why this fourth plenum that ended a couple of weeks ago, it was about rule of law, but they call it Chinese or socialist rule of law with Chinese characteristics, meaning not rule of law with not rule of law. But what it means is the party itself is going to try to clean up its act, which it's starting to do. From our tradition, we believe, at least, I personally believe, that while top-down is critically important, if you don't have bottom-up, and what does bottom-up mean? It means sunshine laws. It means a free media. It means courts that will hold anybody accountable, including members of the party and members of the government. If you don't have that, then top-down reform, in my view, can't work. It can be better than what you have already, but every time when reform from the bottom starts to bubble up from the bottom, whether it's about the Three Gorges Dam or the Sichuan earthquakes or Chengguangcheng or these amazing patriotic students in Hong Kong, that gets squashed immediately. So there's a reform conundrum, and China is basically betting the future of their country that top-down reform can work. But there are a lot of stresses, and a lot of tensions, and they're basically breaking a lot of eggs because economic reforms are being prioritized. And that leads to the third form of legitimacy, which is maintaining a monopoly on expressions of nationalism. And so, as certainly happened in the United States, with all of these big changes happening, the government, just like we did in the Bush administration, is looking for, well, how can we divert people's attentions? And part of it is this nationalist rhetoric. And I talked about the shift between pre-Tiananmen and post-Tiananmen, about the history and the narrative of victimization. But that's getting ramped up significantly, both in internal rhetoric and the anti-Japanese stuff and anti-American and the South and East China Seas. And at the same time, China is undergoing this massive buildup of its armed forces. The military budget in 2003 was about $20 billion, and now it's $150 billion, and that's increasing. Ours, of course, is bigger, but the U.S. is a global power, and China right now is a regional power. So we're moving towards much greater parity. And we talked about China not having access to the resources, including oil and many other things. So they're building a blue water navy to try to protect its sea lanes. But the United States has seen our role as maintaining the open navigation of the seas. So we're going to see, we already are seeing, a lot of back and forth and a lot of potential clashes. And so, as I see it, while there's a lot of opportunity for collaboration, there's also a lot of opportunity for conflict. And what we are seeing, I think, is a de-universalization of values. I talked about Western values becoming universal. Now, those universal values are becoming not universal. And we're seeing the world center of gravity shifting from being over Atlantic or the United States to being over the Pacific, and Asia doesn't have any of the institutions to be ready for that kind of responsibility. So there's a shift of responsibility without the kind of cultures or institutions that can play that global role in at least the way that the United States and our allies would be comfortable with. So there's this all of this tension and all of this churn, and at the same time, all of the countries are trying to become as competitive as they possibly can. And we talked about nationalism, that in Asia today looks in many ways like Europe of the 19th and early 20th centuries, where these strong absolute nationalism, whether it's China, Japan, Korea, and they're bumping up against each other. And so we know what happened in our tradition, but there's a real danger. So we talked about these issues and competitiveness, but there's one area where competitiveness is absolutely essential, and that is human resources. And everybody, the way that we all get ahead in life, in our families, in the world, is just by having the most competitive people who we can have. And that touches on issues of education reform, and nutrition, and schooling, and so many other things. But one area that's critically important for the realization of human resources is genetics. And I'll make a little bit of historical detour, which is that after 200,000 years of evolution, our species is now on the verge for the very first time of taking active control of our evolutionary process, which is a huge idea. We've evolved in one way, and right now, if we just froze science today and said we're not going to have any innovations, any new revolution, so all we have is we'll have incremental increases on technologies that already exist. If we just did that, we already have every tool that we would need to genetically enhance our children. We don't need any other new innovation. We just need to just keep going at roughly the same pace that we are going. So it's guaranteed that that will happen. Here in California, you've had the debate about egg freezing. We've talked about IVF and PGD, which is embryo selection before implantation in IVF. You all know about the Human Genome Project, so that when you're screening embryos, each cell that you extract from each of the blastocysts has the blueprint for the entire human. And we already here in California do embryo selection in IVF. We already have surrogacy, as you all know, which is legal here. And as things move forward, we're just going to have more and more information about what each of those fertilized eggs, those blastocysts, says, and people will be able to make those choices if they so choose. We will start to see genetic diseases as a choice, and increasingly people will not be comfortable leaving that up to chance. So I definitely believe that in whatever 30, 40, 50 years, sex among just big chunks of the population will not be used for procreation. It will be used for all the other good things that sex is for, but it won't be used for having children. As a matter of fact, it will be seen as a radical act, an ideologically driven radical act to have children through sex, or as a demonstration. I know, it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for many people. Or just as a demonstration of being disadvantaged without access. So I definitely believe that we are moving towards this very changed world, and that the science is a J-curve. I mean, the science is advancing exponentially. Our imagination, thinking about it, is only expanding linearly. And the regulatory framework for thinking about it and for trying to address it is just inching forward glacially. And you've seen all of these debates here in California. So there's this huge mismatch. And different societies have different cultural views on whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. And it's both a good thing and a bad thing. We are going to eliminate many genetic diseases that we've suffered with for many, many years. But the very same technologies that allow us to do that will also open the door for our genetically enhanced future. And our children will be genetically enhanced. And as a matter of fact, we're already doing it. There's a vote in Britain at the end of this year on a mitochondrial transfer we can talk about later, but it's basically three-parent children. That's very, very likely going to happen. So we've already, it's not just that we're at the door. We've already passed through the door. But we just have these different pieces of the story, whether it's IVF or egg freezing or Human Genome Project, and we just haven't put all of those pieces together. And when that happens, I talked about cultural differences. Let's just say we in the United States decide, well, we're not going to do this, like we did in the Bush administration about stem cell. Who cares from a historical perspective? Just your Stanford scientists move to Singapore, and they actually get better labs there. And then the law changes here, and they move back. It doesn't really matter what we do individually, but it does matter what we do collectively. But right now, there's a real chance that these issues of human genetics can get subsumed into this national competitiveness issues that I talked about before. So I know many of you have been watching the Olympics for many, many years, and we in the United States have our dirty little trick that we use to win the Summer Olympics, actually all of the Olympics, which is called Title IX. China has its own dirty little trick, and that are these sports schools. And in China, as you know, they identify who the kids are who have great potential for whatever sports. They take them away from their families at an early age. They put them in these sports schools. It's a very platonic idea. And then they train them for their mission without a huge regard for the well-being of the child. But it's this collectivist view that doing this will bring glory to the state, which and the Soviets did that, and many others have done that. Right, but then you think about what happens when states start thinking about genetically enhancing their populations as a means of increasing their competitiveness. And we're already seeing that. And certainly this is happening in multiple places, but in China there's a company called BGI Shenzhen, and they have purchased the largest number of sequencers, genome sequencers in the world from San Diego and elsewhere. They have an initiative called their Cognitive Genomics Initiative, where they're reading the genomes of the smartest people in the world, the geniuses who they can find, trying to figure out, is there a genetic fingerprint of very high intelligence? And there is. It's complicated. It's polygenic. But there is. And over time, because you all know about personalized medicine, all of our children's genomes, all of our genomes will be on file. They'll all be digitized. And when we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 billion people with their genomes digitized, and then we compare real life experiences, who's small, who's tall, who's short, who's smart, who's an Olympic level athlete, we're going to figure out what all of these correlations are. And there are people who are believers or people who believe in the soul who think that human beings are infinitely complex. But there are others who think that human beings are only very massively complex. I'm probably in that school. And if we're only very massively complex, then ultimately humans, and we can say this in California, are a big data problem. There's just a lot of data. It may be more than our computers can process for now or for a long time, but we're a data problem. And we're going to understand more and more, and that's going to allow us to select our embryos first among, if in IVF, let's say it's 10, but then through stem cell technology, when we will be able to produce an unlimited number of female eggs, which is the logjam, people will be able to choose from among 1,000 of their, or 10,000, whatever you can afford, of their potential children. So we are right on the verge of this revolution, and we've already passed through the door, but we're not ready for it. And that brings me to my third talk, and that is the novel. So I've been thinking a lot about these issues. In 2008, I wrote some articles about it. I was invited to testify, as Colleen mentioned, before Congress. And for years I've been thinking about these issues, about the science issues and the policy issues. But the real thing is that, yes, humans are a big data problem. Yes, we are right on the verge of these technological revolutions. But even if we knew everything about the human genome and our genetic code, there are still all of these pieces of our humanity, things that make us human, that at least for now don't show up when you read a genetic code. And those things, as you know, are our human emotions, our connection, our love, all of these things that are the most essential part of being a human being. And so in addition to the articles, I had an article come out in Foreign Affairs a few weeks ago, but I really started thinking about, well, what does it mean on a human level? How should we think about these kinds of issues? And that was the genesis of the novel, Genesis Code. And so the novel is set in 2023 in Kansas City, which by then has won 9 World Series. And all of your best players, because you can't afford to keep them here, have all migrated to Kansas City. So it's 2023, and a reporter for the Kansas City Star is investigating the death of a young woman. And he starts digging, and he learns that this woman was murdered, and that she was carrying a genetically enhanced embryo at the time that she was killed, which is a technology, as far as people know, that doesn't exist. And so he starts digging and digging, and the more he digs, the more all hell breaks loose. And so this guy is suspended from his newspaper, running for his life, and starts to learn more about a big global plot connecting Chinese intelligence and U.S. intelligence and all these other things. And he learns that it wasn't just this woman, that there are other women in the United States who also are carrying these genetically enhanced embryos who are being hunted down and murdered one at a time. And so this guy, running for his life, is trying to figure out who's killing these women and why, and are there any others like them who may still be alive. And while he does that, again, I mentioned he's suspended for his job, he can't rely on all these work relationships that he's had. And so it's just his ex-girlfriend, who he'd broken up with 6 months before, she ends up helping him. And he, who'd broken up with her because he didn't really appreciate everything that she was, realizes that for him, in this struggle for his life, he's missing this essential piece of himself. This is, I guess it's biblical, Genesis. He's missing this essential piece of himself, and it's through connecting with this other person that he can try to achieve what needs to be achieved for this incredibly high stakes outcome. And anyway, so the book, it came out last Tuesday. It's been this great whirlwind of a book tour. And as I tell people, like writing a novel, it took 4 years. It's like you have kind of a wet towel, and you kind of squeeze the water out of that towel. And in this metaphor, the water is your soul, and that water, it kind of congeals into a physical object, and the object is the book. And so there's something kind of very deep and very personal about having this kind of physical thing, and then you kind of put it out into the world, and people consume it as a thing in and of itself. It's like part of you, but separate from you. So I hope that you will treat it gently. If you like or if you don't like the book, I encourage you to engage in quiet meditation and think about that. If you do like the book, I encourage you to tell all of your friends and review it on Amazon and tweet about it and everything else. So anyway, With that, I hope and I haven't spoken too long, and I very much look forward to answering your questions. So thank you.
To work with Jamie when he was the executive vice president at the Asia Society, and he's since moved on to some really interesting topics and things, including, of course, writing this novel, which I've actually read, and I have to say I thought it was a terrific effort. It was very interesting. It held my attention, and I think one of the reasons it did was it set in a definable future, a rather bleak future in a lot of ways. In fact, I'd have to say that if I had an overriding mental image of it, it's kind of a very muted set of colors. And part of it is because it does, I think, represent a somewhat depressing picture for not just the United States, but really, I think, the West in general, and even a little bit for China. But I think one of the interesting elements, too, is that while all these pieces, and Jamie gave us kind of some insights into it, you can see the outlines of that now. And so one of the things I want to look at in this brief conversation before we get to quite a few questions is to find out a little bit about why, what inspired you to write a book. I've obviously, been through my high school and college biology and things, yeah. But we're moving in a new direction here. And what you've done is to take this to a somewhat both... you can clearly see the potential for it, but also the dangers of it. So what inspired you to take on what clearly could be one of the really critical issues of the next generation?
Well, Colleen mentioned that I served in the Clinton administration, the second term on the National Security Council. And my boss then and good friend now is a guy named Richard Clark. And at that time, Dick used to say that if everyone in Washington is focusing on one thing, you can be sure there's something 10 times more important that people aren't focusing on. And he, at that time, was crazed about the issue of terrorism and these crazy people in Afghanistan. And he was saying, we need to be attacking them, we need to be bombing, we need to be invading. And he was totally marginalized. People said, you're insane, you're going to get us all killed, this is the era of globalization. And you know what happened with 9/11, and it turned out that Dick was the guy who had written the memo saying we really need to focus on Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. So I thought a lot about it. What are those issues that are just so important that we're not even thinking about? And I very firmly came to believe that it's the issues of biotechnology and the genetics revolution. So I started reading everything I could, writing everything. When I felt like I was at a certain point, I started writing articles. I mentioned before I was invited to testify before Congress. And then an agent contacted me and said, we should really do a nonfiction book about this, and can you put a book proposal together? So I did. We submitted it. Oxford University Press accepted it, but they said, we want you to make these changes to the proposal. And they were pushing me to make it more and more and more technical. And the more I worked on that more technical book proposal, the more I kept focusing on the first chapter of it, which was a scenario that I'd drawn out of a National Security Council staffer going in to brief the president at some point in the future. And it goes something like this: Mr. President, we've learned that China has a secret genetic enhancement program where they're breeding these super babies and putting them in the equivalent of their Olympic sports schools, but for science and math and engineering business. Wow, that's terrible. What are the implications? Well, we think in 30 years, if they do it and we don't, we won't be able to compete. Can we stop them? No. Can we match them? Well, it's really hard. We have all of these restrictions, cultural and legal and political, and you'll be hounded out of office if you do. And so you're telling me there's nothing we can do, and we're just going to have to just 30 years from now, we're not going to have the kind of leadership to be successful? Well, Mr. President, if you sign right here, we have this idea that we'll set up a front company that no one's going to know about, and we're going to purchase a small chain of fertility clinics in the United States, and we'll start impregnating people who are coming in for fertility treatments with their embryos just genetically enhanced. So people will, you have their kids, it'll look like them, but it'll turn out that their kid is a genius. And people will be thrilled that they have these amazing kids. They're never going to know. So that was, I just started that was the thought experiment. And the more I thought about it, the more I was like, I don't want to write that nonfiction book. I want to kind of imagine what does that world look like, not just from a policy perspective or a science perspective, but from a human perspective. And what does it mean, this craziness about Ebola, where there's a real problem in Africa and we have a sham problem in the United States, but one day somebody showed up with Ebola in the United States, and now people are saying, wow, you know, we should have had all these clues and there was all this information about Ebola and nobody was focusing on it. Someday a genetically enhanced person is going to show up. Actually, it'll be next year because it'll be starting with the mitochondrial transfer in the UK. But somebody, a genetically enhanced person, is going to show up. And all of a sudden, everyone's going to freak out. And at that point, it's going to be much harder to have the conversation that we need to be starting now. And that's just a conversation about what does this all mean? And there aren't easy answers because people say, well, let's just stop all of this today. Well, do we want to stop what's going to cure cancer? Do we want to stop what's going to eliminate all these genetic diseases that have plagued us for hundreds of thousands of years? No. But there are other things. Chimeric people with certain amounts of animal DNA. Like, are we comfortable with that? We will be 10 years from now, for sure, because what we'll have is denucleized rabbit eggs. So just right now, they're experimenting. You take a rabbit egg, you take out the nucleus, you put in a human nucleus. And this is technology that exists today by law. In where this is possible, you have to destroy those eggs or embryos made from them after 14 days. But there's a decentralization of this process. It's called DIY bio or biohacking. And you don't need Lawrence Livermore to do this kind of technology. Increasingly, people can do it in their basement or their garage. And so these are huge issues. And the very first, there are no easy answers, but the first thing that we need is a national and a global conversation. So I've been writing the policy articles, but I just think that people process ideas in different ways. In addition to the policy articles, I wanted to write a novel to bring a different set of people into this conversation and inspire them to talk with their friends, book clubs, and other things, just to try to help push the conversation forward.
So despite the fact that Kansas City didn't do so well in the World Series, actually did pretty well. I mean, 7 games. Why did you set the novel there as opposed to, say, Los Angeles or Silicon Valley or something?
Yeah, well, part of it is because I'm from there, and it just made life easier because I knew all the places. But part of it is that I just feel like when these issues show up, it's not going to be, I live in Manhattan, actually next door to Madonna. She's living a lot better than me. But it's not going to be like in New York or L.A. It'll just be, these issues will just show up in regular places where real people live. And so for me, Kansas City, it's like that kind of just real American place.
I didn't realize there was such a big Armenian American community in Kansas City.
Well, there's not. The main character is named Dikran Azadian, who goes by Rich. And he is from California, from Glendale, where I'm going tomorrow. And he has a PhD in philosophy. And after 3 postdocs, gets kind of disgusted with this abstract life, moves to Kansas City to take this job as a reporter, which in his mind is kind of like inserting him at sea level, where he decides that he wants to live. But he can't get over himself, so he's kind of living his life at sea level, but he's kind of observing his life as a philosopher from 20,000 feet and constantly tripping over himself. So he's kind of going through this fight for his life. But while he does it, he's trying to understand what's happening with his philosophical references, whether it's to Plato or William of Ockham, who's a 14th century British theologian, who's he kind of starts his mind playing out, and this voice in his head says, like, you know, keep it simple, stupid. He references Jorge Luis Borges, and he's kind of struggling between this kind of philosophical life and real life and his relationship with his ex-girlfriend. I won't tell you what happens, but is connected to that, because he's kind of with her, he's kind of processing the relationship and living the relationship simultaneously. They'd broken up 6 months before the novel begins because he can't get himself just to accept his girlfriend for who she is. And so he's like tripping all over himself. But in this fight, he's forced in so many ways to come to terms with his humanity as he addresses this issue of of all of us as a species trying to figure out what our humanity means in this genomic world.
So one thing you lay out is this, and you actually started off with this explanation for why this rivalry between the United States and China grows to a point where it's clearly becoming a very
right.
serious undercurrent in global politics. What enabled you to get to that point? Why do you see that? And I think one of the other questions is that bleak idea or the bleak future you've posited for the United States. Why does the United States find itself kind of on the receiving end, educationally, socially, politically?
Yeah. Well, in the novel, I talk about this future where the United States, our debt has grown, and we have a bond crisis. In the beginning of the novel, we have a bond crisis. And just as we do to the other countries when they have bond crisis. So China and the IMF have gotten together and done a deal for the United States to bail us out of this crisis. And they've put these very strict conditions about what we need to do, which is basically what we do to everybody else. But it turns out that that is what it takes for the United States to start getting its act together. And so a national unity centrist government is created of a centrist Democrats and Republicans. A centrist Republican president and a centrist Democrat vice president come together on this national unity ticket, and they are elected. And they create a thing called the National Competitiveness Act. And what that does is it creates an agency called the National Competitiveness Agency. And so every year, the agency puts together an omnibus bill of all of the changes, everything that needs to happen in the United States to make us more competitive in so many different areas. And just like with base closing, Congress can either vote up or down. You can't have all of these amendments. And so as part of that, the United States is starting to turn the corner. But as the novel begins, the centrist Republican president is being challenged in the Republican primary by a right-wing Republican who is running on these traditional values. And he has a big evangelical Christian movement behind him. And there's an evangelical minister also in Missouri who's connected to this story named Cobalt Becker who is backing him. So there's this whole movement. So there's the culture wars that are happening. And then there's a movement to unseat this national unity government from the Republican right. And so it is dystopian in many, many ways, but it's not purely dystopian. And I think that's probably always the case, that with the genetics, there's the dystopian part and there's the utopian part. And with politics, there's this dystopian and the utopian. And these issues are just challenging.
It's not quite Blade Runner yet.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn to some of the questions. One of these says, given that there's no such thing as politics, it's all economics. China's on a tear to build roads, rails, ships to sell directly to Europe, and now
yep.
deep water ports along with the west coast of America and Canada to sell much of this, much of its output as fast as possible. Is the end game total world domination?
No. Just kidding. There is economics, there is politics. China is doing a very rational thing, which is enhancing its economic position. The United States, we have relationships all around the world. We have military bases all around the world. We have economic relationships around the world. You would expect China, as a big global economy, to build the ports, to build the rails, to do all of those things to enhance their trade. And China has global, starting regional, but ultimately global aspirations. And that's normal, and it's probably even healthy. But my view is that countries, as they begin to grow economically, have to, for the greater good, take on greater responsibility. The United States, we became the world's largest economy in 1890. And you know, I was just in Kansas City earlier in the week, and I went to the World War I Museum, which is this incredible museum. And it talks about how we were doing everything we could to stay out of World War I. And then kicking and screaming at the very, very end, when they kept destroying our ships, then we went in and played a decisive role in tipping the balance. And then we went through this very idealistic phase with Woodrow Wilson and the 14 points and the League of Nations, but then we pulled back and we didn't ratify the League of Nations, and the League of Nations collapsed, and you all know where that leads. So really, 1890 until, let's say, 1941. So 51 years, the United States was in this strong economic position and didn't accept that we had these global responsibilities. But we watched the world fall to hell because we were so big that if we opted out of an international system, it wasn't just that the system was weaker, it was the system doesn't exist. And China, up to this point, I believe, has been gaming the system, not taking no responsibilities, but taking very minimal global responsibilities. In China, they try to kind of play it both ways and say, their leaders say, oh, we're just this little developing country, we can't play this global role. In some cases, they're saying, you better respect us. We're the second largest economy in the world, and soon we're going to be the first, and we demand our say. And I think China has earned a seat at the table. It's earned a bigger voice in international affairs, provided that their sense of their national self-interest is just a bit more what I would call enlightened self-interest. In the United States, we're not purely enlightened self-interest. We have the Vietnam War. We have this madness in Iraq. We have all kinds of errors. But really, I believe from 1945 until today, the United States has laid the foundation for global peace and prosperity through the security arrangements in Europe and Asia and the Marshall Plan and the resuscitation of Japan and Germany and creating the internet and free navigation of the seas. And maybe we could go on and on and on and on. And I just think that China is now at a time where it needs to step up. And if China steps up in a meaningful way, and it may not look exactly like this post-war system, but it will be some variation of that, then that will be great, and we can have more global growth and more success. But if China continues to game the system for its own more narrowly defined national self-interest, then we're going to see big, big, big problems.
Did Edward Snowden's leaks and revelations do enormous, modest, or minimal damage to the U.S. security vis-a-vis China?
Yeah, enormous. I believe there are some who believe that Edward Snowden was a patriot. I believe that he is a scoundrel and a louse and a traitor. That doesn't mean that there weren't real issues, but there are many ways to address those kinds of issues, none of which he did. But what he did do was release all of our secrets. And yes, we all have questions about what's the right role of government with our privacy, but I was so proud of many things that came out in Snowden. For example, that we'd cracked into the cell phone networks of the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So that information is out and that we've lost all of that information, that our secret military codes were given. So I feel like Edward Snowden is just a traitor to the United States, and it's just a terrible shame.
Unlike, moving back on slightly more on topic here, unlike the U.S., today's China may be less constrained by religious, historical religions towards genetic engineering.
Yes.
Or not, question mark. Please comment.
Yeah. I recommend a book which could really help you address some of these issues. I'm trying to remember the name. It's something code... Genesis Code, available in the lobby. that's what the book is about. That there just are different ideas, different backgrounds. We in the West, we have this idea that there's this divine power who's like this watchmaker, but other societies just have a different view. And you think of China, it's a society largely run by engineers, where there's just a lot of engineering. Now, there's engineering. Three Gorges Dam is engineering. The one-child policy is engineering. The south-to-north water diversion program is engineering. And there's just a different sense of what can and can't be engineered. We used to have a view of engineering like this. I mean, eugenics was invented here. But we've pulled back a bit on that, and China is just in a different space. Oh, is this my score? This is like gymnastics. I got a 10. Oh my God! Wow.
So, one of the questions here is, do you really think this could take place? I think it's pretty clear from the conversation. But let me actually rather put it as an interrogative. Do you really think that such a thing could happen? Because there are constraints, both moral, some legal. I think one of the things that's out here is clearly that the legal boundaries haven't yet been really fully explored, but. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you think about the way that such a thing could either be averted or might be likely to happen?
I think it's guaranteed that it will happen. I mean, name one revolutionary technology that had the potential to do a lot of good and the potential to do a lot of bad that we and our hubristic ancestors haven't embraced. There's absolutely no way that the future of our species does not involve genetic engineering. It's, in my mind, it's just impossible to imagine. But that doesn't mean that we have to be in an environment where everything goes. We've had nuclear energy for a long time, and it's been imperfect, but we've not everybody has nuclear weapons. I mean, more countries are getting them, but there are ways to build norms. Chemical weapons, again, it's another technology that not everybody has. But to do it, to build those norms, we need to be having global conversations. And we're not having the kinds and the level of conversation that we need to have. And that's why I'm in touch with people in U.S. Congress. And what I've said is, let's just start with a national commission. Just get some smart people and frame some questions, not answers, questions. And try to structure a national first and then a global conversation about these questions in a way that can bring people together, people of faith, people of different backgrounds and different perspectives, because it would be very easy to just have this conversation, have it devolve, and people are going to freak out. I mean, right now, if you think, and you're here in California, that the debate about GMOs, genetically modified organisms, is intense, wait till genetically modified humans start showing up.
GMOs on steroids.
Yeah. GMHs. What are people going to do? Will people get violent? Maybe. Probably. But now is the time where we can even have this conversation, and that's why I think it's really important that we do it.
Here's an interesting divergence. Is China part of a resurgence, and you talked a little bit about this earlier, part of a resurgence of ethnic nationalism that includes India, Israel, et cetera, but may exclude the West?
Yes. As I said before, in the West, we see nationalism as part of the problem, as something that we had to overcome after we'd played it out through the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century. And that's why our whole history of the last 70 years is about overcoming nationalism, which we see as something wrong. I spent 3 weeks in Germany a few months ago, and it's this ultra-nationalist country, and now nationalism is seen as something that you need to be embarrassed about. In Asia and in many parts of the world, that's not the case at all. As a matter of fact, nationalism, as I said before, is essentially connected to the legitimacy of those governments. So what we're seeing is a resurgence of the kind of 19th and 20th century nationalisms that we know from the past. From a Western perspective, we've seen this story before, and we know where it leads. But it's really hard to contain those kinds of nationalisms. But having said that, if those are going to be the rules, we are going to be in a world guided by nationalism, we in the West also have a great history of dealing with those nationalisms. The Treaty of Vienna in 1815, we basically had about 100 years where, through balance of power politics, nationalisms were largely contained. And if we need to dust off those history books, then maybe we need to dust off those history books. I mean, it's not this view of the future that the founders of the UN and the UN conventions had, but maybe that's the best that we can do.
Here's one. It says, Title IX is a dirty little secret?
Yes. Yeah.
How can equalizing opportunities for the genders be dirty? And by the way, this person was at the Game 7 of the World Series in Kansas City.
Yeah. Oh, good. The dirty little secret. So here's my view, and I know this is California, and I'm going to get beaten up, and I just hope that if there are people who are going to be watching this video in the future, thank you for lasting 53 minutes. But my view is that we have in a world of unlimited resources, we should have unlimited funding for everything. But in a world of limited resources, we need to figure out how we are going to portion out educational opportunities. And I personally believe that because in the goal of reaching parity in sports funding, we're just diverting a lot of money that I think would be better spent towards giving people real educations in science and math and engineering and all of those other things. And so I totally support equality, but I think that we do have these revenue-generating sports like football, And rather than just using the football money to support women's fencing, and I love women's fencing, and all these investments, as I said before, in women's sports are what let us win the Olympics, because our women outperform our men always. I just rather say, well, we're going to have this money, and it's going to go for educational opportunities and scholarships for women. I'd rather have more women scientists and engineers and lawyers and doctors than more women fencers and softball players, although I love women fencers and softball players.
Well, if you were going to set out to avoid this future, besides allowing philosophically minded Armenian Americans to go to the Cal philosophy department, how would you do it?
Well, the goal isn't to avoid this future. This is our future. The goal is to balance possible futures so we avoid the two extremes. We avoid the Luddite extreme of squashing this technology that has the opportunity to really benefit us in such miraculous ways. I mean, anybody who suffers from Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, cancer, if you say, well, we're going to squash this future and these things are natural, like enjoy this natural life, that's no way to live. That's not what we do as humans. On the other end of the spectrum, if you say, well, we're going to be in H.G. Wells' Island of Dr. Moreau, and you can imagine all kinds of nightmare scenarios, that's not the future either. So what we need to do is to find this balance that avoids the extremes, and that's what I think the conversation needs to lead us towards.
So two last questions, and one of them is off the topic of the book, but on the topic of Asia, which is, what do you make of the hostility between Japan's president and China's president at the summit? And of course, I think one of the interesting things is what brought Obama and Xi Jinping together in a way that made sense. That's not on here, but that's a good question. And does this bode ill for the relationship between the two countries?
Yeah. So Japan certainly has taken a nationalist turn under Abe. But you would expect Japan to take a nationalist turn when China has put so much enormous pressure on Japan. From 1945 until today, Japan has been one of the most globally responsible countries in the world. Japan has done huge amounts of investing in Asia. China's growth story was in many ways funded by and modeled by Japan. Japan has funded the United Nations. Japan pays 13% of the funds for the entire United Nations. China pays 3%. So Japan has earned the global role, and it's been very, very humble. They've made mistakes, certainly with the Senkaku Islands, the Diaoyu Island. Japan has made mistakes. And China, I think, is very aggressively pushing on Japan in a way that is designed to not only exert dominance vis-a-vis Japan, but also to make a statement about the U.S.-Japan alliance. And they're also doing this with the Philippines and others. Because if China can bully Japan and bully the Philippines, and there's a question about what role the United States is going to play in supporting them, and China's been very smart and very strategic in making these little claims on little rocks that no one's going to go to war over, then it really weakens the U.S. alliance system. So I think that's what it's. It's not just about China-Japan relations. It's about America's future in the Western Pacific, and there are much bigger, broader issues. And that's why China very artfully has really pushed hard on Japan and then has just now pulled back the throttle with this meeting and this connection between Abe and Xi at the APEC meeting, because they're just trying to change the baseline. And when you're the emperor and then people come and it's like, oh, things have been really bad, but now we're gonna let things get a little bit better. So China is very smart and very strategic. They've earned a much greater role in world affairs, and they are taking that role. But I just think that China needs to show more global responsibility. And hopefully they will. And like I said, with the U.S., it's also a transition process, but that transition needs to happen.
So we have time for one last question, and I think it actually came to me very naturally. I see many possibilities for sequels.
Yes.
And the question is,
yes.
And they can go a number of different directions.
Yes.
But I guess the question is, ultimately, do you plan to produce a sequel for this?
Well, funny you should ask. And we haven't, this was not a setup, but I've written the sequel, which we haven't yet submitted to publishers. It's called Eternal Sonata, and it deals with issues with stem cell treatments that reverse the aging process. But you lose all of your memories as a result. And as the novel opens, The globally renowned scientists dying of terminal cancer are disappearing from hospices around the world. And nobody notices and nobody cares because these guys are all half dead. Except one of these people ends up disappearing in Kansas City. And our friend, Dick Ron, is sent, because now he's doing more on these kinds of weird things, he's sent to go look at that story. And he starts a story. He starts piecing together this bigger story. And lo and behold, all hell breaks loose.
Can't wait.
Eternal Sonata.
That'll be on the shelves in a couple of years, and we'll be back here.
We'll be back here, yes.
Our thanks to Jamie Metzl, who former Clinton administration. Give him applause early. National Security Council, State Department official, former executive vice president of the Global Asia Society, and author of the new novel, Genesis Code. I'm Bruce Pickering, executive director of the Asia Society Northern California Center, and your moderator for today's audience question period. You're listening to Commonwealth Club Radio Network. Our guest is Jamie Metzl, former Clinton. I got that already.
Yeah,
sorry.
Bruce,
you're going to have to edit this one out, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm going to close the program before I embarrass myself anymore.